Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a very exciting program for you today. Kevin, why don't you tell us what's on the OR schedule for today?
On the schedule for today, we have Dr. Weigelt, a professor of surgery and chief of the Division of Trauma and Critical Care at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Weigelt is also the medical director of CSAP 15 and is also the coordinating editor for Practical Reviews in General Surgery. Today, he'll discuss what goes into making CSAP. He'll also discuss the complexities of anticoagulation in the trauma patient, and he'll give us his tips and tricks for managing duodenal trauma. For our random fact of the day, we'll learn about the history of blood transfusions, but first, our opening shot.
So today's opening shot, we're going to talk a little bit about abdominal trauma. Jake, tell us a little bit about the epidemiology of abdominal trauma.
Yeah, sure. You have two broad categories. You have penetrating and blunt abdominal trauma. With penetrating trauma, you know, you have things like stab wounds, gunshot wounds, with stab wounds being far more common. However, gunshot wounds cause about 90% of the deaths. Most commonly injured organs in penetrating injury are the small intestine, a little bit more than the colon, a little bit more than the liver.
Kevin, it's a little bit different with blunt abdominal trauma. So tell me a little bit more. Is mortality, for example, higher, lower? What is it?
Yeah, surprisingly, overall, it's a greater mortality than penetrating trauma. And this is related to the fact that it's more difficult to diagnose and multiple organ systems that are damaged.
What are the organ systems that are typically damaged?
So this is debated, but generally it's thought that the spleen is most commonly damaged, followed closely by the liver. And then the intestine is the most common hollow viscus.
So in general, I know that especially depending on how old you are, if it's a younger population, the young male or the older population, what are the most common causes of blunt abdominal trauma?
By far, motor vehicle accidents.
And then what else?
Blows to the abdomen, such as a fist fight.
And then finally falls. And again, this changes, no question, depending on the patient that we're dealing with. So, you know, not too surprising, penetrating abdominal wounds, stab wounds can come from about anything, gunshot wounds, maybe a little bit more small bowel, colon, liver that we talked about. But Jay, the pathophysiology of injury is kind of interesting when we talk about blunt abdominal trauma. Mm-hmm. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So with blunt trauma, you're dealing with rupture or burst injury. It can be of a hollow organ by a sudden rise in the intra-abdominal pressures. You can have a crushing effect. You can have acceleration, deceleration forces causing shear injury. You can have seatbelt injuries as seen with motor vehicle accidents.
Yeah, so essentially you're talking about a comforting thing. You're talking, I get the actual hit itself, the crush. I can get the shear, the whiplash, yeah. You know, your classical ones. Then you also get the pressure rise that comes with it. And seatbelt injuries are a common source. It's a look into the abdomen to be able to say that the impact sustained by the patient is such that if it's going to cause a seatbelt sign, that there's probably something else going on within. Kevin, physical exam on these particular patients, and again, I understand that it's the ABCs, all of that stuff. Just what are some high points about this specific?
Yeah, the physical exam is generally unreliable due to distracting injuries, altered mental status, and spinal cord injuries. But things you are going to look for is things you look for in any abdominal exam is abdominal tenderness, peritoneal signs, any signs of hemorrhage or flank hematomas, entrance and exit wounds, distension.
So I do a digital rectal exam and I don't see any blood. Am I good?
No.
Yeah, I think that's a take-home point. Yeah, I mean, if you do mm-hmm. see blood, that might be valuable. But, you know, if there's no blood, that doesn't necessarily doesn't mean that nothing else is going on. Jay, the guy comes in. A lot of times we have set trauma panels that we're going to be able to do, but walk me through that.
You know, lab tests, they can be helpful, but they can also be normal. If you have a significant blood loss, you look for your hematocrit. You can look if you have a viscous injury, you might have an elevated white count. Lactate is plus or minus on its helpfulness. You look for, you know, pancreatic injuries or hollow viscous injuries with amylase or lipase specifically for pancreas injuries.
So, Kevin, everybody that comes to me in the emergency room has some sort of radiographic imaging. Give me a couple of high points in terms of the plain films, CAT scan, things that we're looking for abdominal injury.
Right. So for the plain films, you're going to see some intraperitoneal air if there is a hollow viscous injury. You also see fractures, which will give you clues to which organs to look near. And then you can also see if there's any foreign bodies.
Everybody gets a CAT scan from head to toe. So what are we looking for?
So this will be much more accurate in diagnosing solid visceral lesions and intraperitoneal hemorrhage, and it'll guide non-operative management to solid organ injury.
Do you give oral contrast?
No, just the IV.
So, you know, as we're going through these ones, there's obviously, we'll go into, do you need angiography, CT angiography? There's a lot of different ones that'll go in there, but one of the mainstays in many places is the FAST exam. Yeah. Jay, tell a little bit about the FAST exam.
Sure. The FAST exam is fast. It can be done in the emergency room. It's an acronym for the Focused Assessment with Sonography for Trauma. It's mainly to diagnose free intraperitoneal blood after blunt trauma. The four areas you look for are the perihepatic and hepaticorenal space or Morrison's pouch, the perisplenic area, the pelvis, pouch of Douglas, retrovesical pouch, and the pericardium. It's about 60 to 95% sensitive for detecting about 100 to 500 mLs of fluid.
Now, they also do have the extended FAST or the EFAST, where they look for the sliding lung sign to look mm-hmm. for a pneumothorax. That's common. And again, the sensitivity with that is pretty low, less than 60%, but the specificity is actually pretty good, about 99% for detecting a pneumothorax. We all know that, again, like most things, as you talked about before, that I loved, you said that the initial thing about a FAST was it was fast, but that is true, right? It's fast, it's repeatable, you can do it right at the bedside, there's no radiation or contrast. But Kevin, what are some downsides of the FAST?
Well, you can't really look for solid parenchymal damage or retroperitoneal hemorrhage or any diaphragmatic defects. And then it really depends on the patient. An obese patient will have limited views, or if they have a lot of substantial bowel gas.
So, yeah, and again, if you got a patient, God forbid, that's also, you know, a cirrhotic with some ascites or has some underlying fluid, you can't distinguish blood from fluid. And there really is a false negative rate that extends upwards of greater than 25% in these people for detecting a hemoperitoneum. Jay, old school, if we wanted to find ourselves in a pinch, DPL, does that still have a role?
Well, it's largely been replaced by the FAST and the widespread use of CT scan. It can be used in blunt trauma to triage a patient who is hemodynamically unstable and can't go to the CT scanner with an equivocal FAST exam.
Yeah, so again, just for more test-taking purposes than anything, Kevin, DPL, tell us a little bit about that, and specifically what makes a positive test.
So a positive test in blunt trauma or stab wound to the anterior flank or back, you're going to look for a red blood cell count that is greater than 100,000.
And
if it's in the lower chest or gunshot wound, you're going to look for a red blood cell count greater than 5 to 10,000.
Yeah, and again, we also talk about, you know, 10 cc's of gross blood, or is it, you know, do you see, you know, peas and carrots,
when bile.
Bile, things like that, that what we're looking for. So, yeah, especially with stab wounds. Somebody comes in with a stab wound, Jay, and let's say they're a little bit obese. They get it into the, you know, into the belly near the anterior left upper quadrant right there. Is there a role for local wound exploration in these patients?
Yeah, you can do a local wound exploration to determine the depth of the penetration of the stab wound. If the peritoneum is at all violated, if you suspect even that the peritoneum is violated, you must do more diagnostics.
Yeah, so again, in many cases, you know, either this is where the non-selective management of penetrating abdominal trauma may come in, or laparoscopy, to be able to stick a scope in, take a look around, see what's going on and miss in there. Now, Kevin, where does laparoscopy really find its use in these particular patients?
Right. There are a few injuries that are really difficult to see otherwise, and that's the diaphragmatic injuries. So with laparoscopy, it has a sensitivity of 87% and a specificity for 100% in diagnosing these. And you can also repair organs when you're laparoscopic. You can repair the diaphragm. You can repair liver injuries, stomach injuries, small bowel injuries.
Yeah, and I won't say necessarily you can, but I think that maybe some people can out there. It does have its disadvantages, though. And what are those disadvantages?
It has a very low sensitivity for hollow viscous injuries. And the retroperitoneum, you can't feel confident about that.
So, Jay, if we're talking about abdominal injury in terms of management, there's some general principles. We know about the ATLS principles that we're going to do with everybody. Yep. But, you know, take me through. Patient comes in. Give me some big principles. Are we using antibiotics? And let's say you got somebody gets shot and the bullet's way in the back. Am I going to dig that bullet out?
Maybe in the 17th century, but not currently. As far as antibiotics, you want to decrease the risk of intra-abdominal sepsis. So you want to start broad spectrum against enteric organisms, levofloxacin, As always, you know, all trauma, you start with your ABCs, and you want to, if you have any exposed viscera, you want to cover it with moist dressing.
Kevin, we'll step back in time, and there was a time and a place, even when I trained, that everybody who had a penetrating abdominal injury, they got a neck slap. So that was, you know, pretty much standard of care. So where is this component of selective management? Why is it there? And is there other diagnostic studies or things that we can do to replace the mandatory exploration? And what do we do about that?
Yeah, so this is an evolving area still. And the mandatory laparotomy obviously has a morbidity associated with it. So anything we can do to reduce that would be good. So, and about 70% of abdominal stab wounds, it's thought to be unnecessary to do a laparotomy.
So they about 70% of cases, mm-hmm. they go to the operating room and they get a negative exploration. So this strategy for the selective type ones, though, again, so we're trying to cut down that rate. We mentioned laparoscopy. CAT scanning, is that useful? Is that not useful? I mean, I've read some papers out there that talk about the addition of having either rectal contrast, for example, the flank stab wounds that will add in addition to IV contrast to be able to detect that. That can potentially identify whether there is somebody that needs to go to the operating room or not. And again, a large part of this depends on exactly what we're dealing with. Okay, Jay, we got a penetrating abdominal trauma in the anterior abdomen. So the questions that come out to you all the time is to be able to say, do we need to go to the operating room? Let's assume they go to the operating room. You're going to take care of whatever that is. But let's just take a peek and say, on that particular patient, if they don't have a mandatory injury, a mandatory reason that they go to the operating room right offhand, what type of things should probably we be doing in these patients?
Yeah, these are the patients that I think CT scan is very useful for potentially identifying intra-abdominal injuries. You can observe if they're stable and you don't see a something taking you to the OR mandatorily, you can observe them.
Kevin, in terms of penetrating abdominal trauma to the back or the flank injury, again, in this particular one, we're talking about injuries of the kidneys, some of the, you know, the pancreas, other things like that. How often is an intraperitoneal organ associated with a back or flank penetrating abdominal injury?
It's more rare. It's only about 15 to 40% of the time.
And what's the problem with some of the standard bedside tests? We mentioned this a little bit earlier.
Yeah, the abdominal exam and the FAST are very unreliable in this situation. So this is when you really want to consider getting a CT scan.
So we can also classify penetrating abdominal trauma by the mechanism of what the underlying one is. And so we talked a little bit before about stab wounds having a negative exploration on the mandatory side upwards of 70% of the time. Jay, gunshot wounds, how do they differ from stab wounds?
Well, first off, they have a much higher mortality. And most of these are going to have a peritoneal penetration and have an injury requiring operative management. So therefore, most people would proceed to the don't pass go, proceed to the operating room with a gunshot wound to the abdomen.
Rounding out this opening shot to touch very briefly on blunt abdominal trauma, we know that in many cases these patients have multi-system injuries. In many cases, they have altered mental status, making the examination much less reliable. And so we rely more on our diagnostic studies, with the caveat, obviously, that if a patient comes in and they're hemodynamically unstable, you know, we got to do what we ought to do in that particular situation. But indications, Kevin, for a laparotomy after blunt trauma?
Well, clearly unstable vital signs. And then if they have peritoneal irritation or pneumoperitoneum, if you have any concern for a diaphragmatic injury, if there's any signs of gastrointestinal bleeding.
Yeah, and you know those are very easy to say in a textbook, but we all know that you know you got a person who's got an equivocal exam, they got a little bit of blood there, where's it coming from? You know, the unstable vital signs aren't there. So, you know, damage control has served a purpose. It's, you know, originating from, you know, the naval ship type use in the DOD. So the tenets of damage control laparotomy, Kevin?
You want to control hemorrhage and control contamination.
Yeah, so those are the two major ones. And then we're going to fight the fight another day. Jay, we're going to be able to do those two things. So damage control, does damage control have to go back to the ICU in order to have your resuscitation?
No, absolutely not. You can resuscitate them and perform definitive repair of the injuries. They don't necessarily have to go back to the ICU.
You can do everything you can do in the operating room that you can do in the ICU, and don't lose sight of that fact. So, Kevin, just some very quick indications for a damage control procedure.
So, indications for damage control, if the patient is hemodynamically unstable, if they have a significant coagulopathy, or they're acidotic, in hypothermic patients, patients that the operative time to repair the injuries that they have would be excessive.
Yeah, a lot of those things come to pass. And, you know, they talk about other ones like multiple penetrating ones or visceral type injuries or transfusions. But if you go back to the very basics to say, patients did poorly when we tried to do too much for too long and got behind that physiological curve in the operating room, prevent the contamination, stop the bleeding, fight the fight another day. So that's been your opening shot.
All right, well, that sound means it's time for our random fact of the day.
So today, our random fact of the day is going to focus on blood transfusions. Did you know that blood transfusions date back to the 1600s, Jay?
I did.
Well, in 1628, British physician William Harvey discovers a circulation of blood. The first known blood transfusion is attempted soon thereafter. Now, the thing that really made this possible is in 1658, microscopist Jan Swammerdam observed and described red blood cells. But really, in 1665, the first recorded successful blood transfusion occurred in England when physician Richard Lower kept dogs alive by transfusing blood from other dogs. But really, this is just dogs to dogs. Tell me a little bit more about the human transfusion.
Yeah, in 1667, Jean-Baptiste Denis in France and Robert Lower and Edmund King in England all separately reported the successful transfusion of blood from sheep into humans.
Wait a second. So the first human transfusion was not human to human?
Apparently, it was sheep to human.
By the way, very nice job on your Jean-Baptiste Denis.
Thank you. I've been working on it for hours.
Now, flash forward, 1800s was really when the first patient transfusion was done from human to human. It was in 1818 when British obstetrician James Blundell performed the first successful transfusion of human blood to a patient. And for what condition, Kevin?
Postpartum hemorrhage.
And that has been your random fact of the day. Okay, well, welcome Behind a Knife. We're very pleased today to have John Weigelt, who is a professor of surgery and chief of the Division of Trauma and Critical Care at the Medical College of Wisconsin. In addition, he is the coordinating editor for Practical Reviews in General Surgery. He's the medical director for CSAP 15, and he's the editor-in-chief of Journal Surgical Education. So, sir, welcome to Behind the Knife. We're very pleased to have you here.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
God, that's a lot of hats. How do you manage your time?
Well, I've learned a lot over the years. I am an early riser, and I manage to steal most of the time from about 4 o'clock in the morning till about 7 o'clock in the morning is my private time when I can do things that I have to do related to my extra mural activities, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those of you out there that aren't familiar with kind of your bio sketch, sir, can you give us a little bit of background? Where'd you grow up? Where'd you train? And how you came to the pass where you're at the Medical College of Wisconsin?
Sure. I grew up in Chicago. I am a Midwest product.
Not a Bears fan, though, are you?
A Bears fan? Of course I'm a Bears fan.
Living in Milwaukee, you're not a Packer fan?
I am not a Packer fan. I unfortunately grew up close to Wrigley Field, so I spent many days in the spring and the fall watching baseball first and then football, and was also sad to see the Bears leave Wrigley Field, but Soldier Field is a much better venue for football than Wrigley Field was in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
I did start in Chicago, and then I went first to Michigan State University, and I went there primarily to get a degree in veterinary medicine. And while I was there, there was a couple of faculty who encouraged a number of us to pursue human medicine after we finished our veterinarian degree. I was one of those that did it. I then went to medical school here in Milwaukee. Actually, I was accepted at Marquette, but by the time I arrived, it became the Medical College of Wisconsin. Finished my degree here and then went to UT Southwestern. Spent 18 years doing my training at Parkland and then staying on the faculty. And then in 1992, I left to become the vice chair at the University of Minnesota, as well as chair of surgery at the St. Paul campus at Ramsey for the university, and then spent 8 years, arrived back here in Milwaukee, where I am still practicing at the Medical College of Wisconsin again and at Froedtert Hospital. That's brief.
Yeah, so that very interesting. We noticed that in your bio that you originally started out as a vet. Did you you ever miss it? You ever think anything like that? Or did you ever practice at all as a vet? Or did you just go right into following the role of the medical school?
No, I practiced through medical school. I moonlit as a veterinarian all the way through medical school, paid my bills that way. And then when I went to Dallas, while many of my colleagues at that time, you could still moonlight. I did not moonlight as a human doctor, but I moon veterinarian. The malpractice costs were a little bit lower. And so I spent my time doing night call for some of the vets in Dallas while I was an intern in second year.
Sir, I'm a big fan of the CSAP audio companion. How many iterations have you been with CSAP? How did you get involved? And how has CSAP evolved?
Well, I got involved because of Dr. Irwin Thal. Dr. Thal was one of my mentors at UT Southwestern. And he got me involved back with CSAP 8. I joined the CSAP crew as an author in CSAP 8. I am now putting together CSAP 16. So it's been a long duration of involvement. I have clearly loved every iteration of CSAP. I think it is a great product by the American College of Surgeons. I think I am very proud to be involved with it, and I really do believe that it meets the needs of practicing general surgeons as well as residents who are entering surgery as they finish their training. It has evolved quite a bit. We have obviously gone from print only to where now we have about a 50-50 mix of our users using the electronic mode and 50% still using just print. We've also changed some of the categories as the American Board. We try to mimic the American Board of Surgery categories for re-verification. They're not always exact, but they're close. And so every issue that we produce, we look at our categories and say, are they still pertinent to the practicing general surgeon? It's a much more rigorous CME product and learning event than it has been in the past, but I think it's evolved as all.
And one last question referring to CSAP. I was wondering, what has been your single favorite interview?
Boy. There's a lot of them that people talk about my interview with Dr. Karen Barazzle a lot. Karen obviously is one of my trainees, and I thought that was a very good one. The other one that's very good is John Hanks. When I interviewed John Hanks, I think that was CSAP 14. He and I had a good interchange. Actually been a whole bunch of them that are just fun to, just like you're doing with me right now. I mean, it's just fun to talk about things and hear people's opinions and push them a little bit about how they really do things. So I hope that most people think most of them are pretty good.
No, definitely
well,
do.
Well, speaking of pushing people a little bit, sir, we're going to delve into our dissection of the day. And this is the portion of the podcast where we focus in on a topic from one of our experts in the field. And again, we are very pleased to have you along with us. And we're going to focus today on anticoagulation strategies in the multi-injury trauma patient. So, okay, sir, you got a 56-year-old female who you're called down to the ER. She's been involved in a blunt MVC. Amongst some other smaller things, she's got a very bad comminuted femur fracture. And ortho wants to put an X fixer on it in the next day. How do you handle anticoagulation in that patient?
So her your only injuries are an open tib fib. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, she's got a comminuted open femur fracture.
Femur fracture. Okay. So, I mean, without a head injury, we would let that, we would screen that person for other injuries, obviously. Mm-hmm. And if there were no other injuries, we would let that patient go to the operating room as soon as possible. In fact, I was just looking at our TQIP data regarding time to operating room with our femurs and tibial fractures, and we are beating the median in the TQIP by quite a bit. Let's just say that. Mm-hmm. So we get them to the operating room fairly quickly. If they are then have no other contraindications, such as a brain injury, solid organ injury, we would start anticoagulation usually within the next 24 hours. Since they're going to go back to the operating room, our orthopedic surgeons do not like low molecular weight heparin, so we would give unfractionated heparin. We would use 5,000 Q8 on that patient until their femur or their tib fib was completely finished with operative intervention. After that, until they were completely ambulatory, we would continue them on. At that time, we would switch them to low molecular weight heparin dose twice a day, and that would be continued until they were completely ambulatory and certainly not bedridden.
Let's say you're at a small town that maybe their TQIP data is not as stout as yours, and ortho's pretty stacked, and the one guy on call isn't going to be able to get that person in for 24 hours. Would you do anything about anticoagulation or DVT prophylaxis in that scenario?
In that 56-year-old woman who is probably on a little bit of the overindulgence side, I would say that we probably would put them on 5,000 Q8 of unfractionated heparin, and then make sure that when everybody knows that, and make sure that the timing of that is stopped, or the dose is stopped before the planned operative intervention.
Same scenario. Now radiology calls you back and they say, you know what? On re-review, she's just got the smallest ditzel in the left frontal lobe, maybe a little contusion, maybe a little subarachnoid. So just a very small, you know, could kind of saw it on re-read. How does that change your anticoagulation protocol?
Well, I'm going to make the assumption that you have left something out and that I had already looked at the CT scan and I had decided that it did not have anything there, so I would have to relook at the CT scan myself and see if this was fabrication on the radiologist's standpoint. I might have to go talk to them, but if it was really there and we both missed it, then we usually delay anticoagulation. In this case, with one extremity injured, we would put a squeezer on the uninjured side, and we would not anticoagulate that person until we had a repeat CT scan, usually within 12 to 24 hours, which showed no progression of this little ditzel. And then at that point, if the patient was going to go to the operating room, which in our place, they would certainly probably go to the operating room, but if you're going to delay it again, we would once again start unfractionated heparin until ortho was finished, and then we'd switch them to low molecular weight heparin. We have a pretty firm protocol, and our neurosurgeons agree that our delay, depending upon the severity, if it's a bad head, will certainly delay all the way to 24 hours and sometimes 48 or 72 hours. But really, a normal follow-up CT scan with no progression is our trigger to ask the question, can we do pharmacologic prophylaxis?
That's awesome. So let's take a step back from that scenario and just talk more globally. And, you know, some of this is, I guess, the question that comes up is, does it differ in your mind between the type of head injury, meaning is it a very small subarachnoid or like a little sliver of a subdural, you know, not the big one right there. And how do you handle that in terms of your choice of anticoagulation and the timing? Where does that differ? And then one other follow-up question, which is saying after you get the go-ahead to start anticoagulation in the face of a head injury, do you then, with a CT scan showing no progression, will you get a follow-up or just follow that patient clinically? And what do you do if they're intubated?
Once there's a stable, I'll answer that last part first, easiest part. Once they have a stable head, and even when they're intubated, if they really, the CT scan is no progression, we will basically not follow them up with a CT scan.
Okay.
So we do not rush them down to CT scan on a routine basis just because they've had a head injury diagnosed on CT scan and we're giving them anticoagulation.
And then the size and the type of the head injury in terms of choice and timing?
Well, on those large ones, those are the ones that neurosurgery, even though the CT scan may be stable, there are ones that we have a very lively discussion about when we really feel it's safe to start anticoagulation. And while what I said is true for the majority of our patients, we do have patients that neurosurgery will say, this is such a severe head injury, we are worried about bleeding if you're going to give them anticoagulation, and we would prefer you not to use anticoagulation. On those patients, we would essentially use mechanical prophylaxis only until neurosurgery felt comfortable. Is there any rule at that point of when they're going to feel comfortable? No. On those, we would probably get a follow-up CT scan. It's usually not on 24 hours. It's usually on 48 hours because we've seen that the change at 24 hours isn't going to convince our neurosurgical service to say it's okay. So we delay that a little bit. So there is that group that does fall out of what our protocol actually says. But the small ones, once we have that stable CT scan, we have become fairly accustomed from the neurosurgeons and our trauma service to anticoagulating them, as I have already mentioned.
Does your choice of agent depend on the service that you're dealing with? Meaning ortho wants you to use one type, neurosurgery wants you to use another type, and how do you balance that if it does change between the multi-system injured patient?
Well, we are still the ones that order it, and so to try to keep everybody happy in the family, we will usually defer to what the person, what the service asked for. And on that patient who's going back and forth to the operating room, our general approach is to use unfractionated heparin and then to switch them, once they're through with the operating interventions, to switch them to low molecular weight heparin.
Okay, so just a few more questions on the chemical prophylaxis. Do you weight-base that Lovenox? And then do you have any role for fondaparinol and direct thrombin inhibitors?
We do weight-base. Okay, that's first thing. So that we do. Now, fondaparinol is an interesting drug. I don't know. If you're talking about routine use of fondaparinol, we do not do that. Fondaparinol is available, and where we do use it is we use it to substitute for heparin when we have a patient who is being treated with heparin and we are worried that they may have heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. We and our pharmacy department are pretty convinced that as a heparinoid, that fondaparinol has a almost zero cross-reactivity for heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, and it's a lot cheaper than the direct thrombin inhibitors, or at least up to this point, the direct thrombin inhibitors, which is Agatroban and Bivalirudin. So that's how we use fondaparinol right now. As far as the oral direct thrombin inhibitors, we are going through the transition like everybody else is, and we are beginning to see the oral direct thrombin inhibitors being used at discharge, especially for that patient, as you started, with that lower extremity injury that is not ambulatory, that is still going to be, you know, more bedridden than up and about, And instead of sending them home on twice daily Lovenox, we basically have switched and are sending some of those home on an oral direct thrombin inhibitor. The issue there many times is cost and trying to weigh the cost. If the patient can get the oral agent and is covered, then we will definitely use it. If not, we may even be sending those people home on Coumadin based upon the cost of the drug and the patient's ability to pay.
Looking at it from the other end of the spectrum, just the patient that comes in these days on Xarelto in a multi-injured patient, what do you do with these guys? Do you give them PCC? What do you? I mean, how are you dealing with them depending on the mechanism of injury or a suspicion, splenic hematoma, something along like that?
Well, I happen to give that lecture in the general surgery review course. So the answer is easy. The first thing you have to do is you got to find out if at all possible when they had their last dose and how long they've been on it. Because the dose, dabigatran, is available or is about a 17-hour half-life, 12 to 17-hour half-life. The other half-lives, rivaroxaban, is about 12 to 14. So if they haven't taken their morning dose and they get injured in the morning, we may not worry too much about that. On the other hand, we do use TEG now, and so TEG can be used to assess what the coagulation status of those patients are. We're learning how to use TEG in that situation, so that's another step you can take. Now, if they've just taken their dose dabigatran and they really look like they have active hemorrhage, the only way that you can give them PCC, but the likelihood that it's going to really be effective is probably no more than 40%, mm-hmm. and that's an estimate. And if you really think they have life-threatening hemorrhage, the issue is, A, surgical means to stop the bleeding, and then, B, dialysis. Dialysis for about 3 hours will usually remove enough of the drug that you will be able to correct their coagulopathy. The rivaroxaban you would use, and apixaban you would use PCC, and again you would probably follow them with TEG, or we would follow them with TEG, but there isn't an easy answer to that, and that was one of the major concerns when we started sending people home on these oral agents about were we creating a monster for ourselves if something would happen in the post-injury period.
Sir, can you describe the patient that you would consider putting a prophylactic IVC filter in?
I would tell you first that we rarely use them. The services that use them and request them at this point, and so we are involved, is the multiply injured patient with a pelvic fracture, a bad pelvic fracture, who orthopedics knows they're going to be at bed rest for a protracted period of time. That patient many times will get a prophylactic retrievable filter. The other group is the head injured patient who the neurosurgeons believe very strongly that they are going to be afraid of pharmacologic prophylaxis for a protracted period of time, and they may request an IVC filter in those patients. On the other hand, they have backed off a lot, as we have shown that, or as the data has shown, that the prophylactic IVC filter is not necessarily a cure-all. And so in that patient population, we do screen our patients. We don't screen all of our patients for DVT, but we do ultrasound screening on those two types of patients, mm-hmm. Identify lower extremity and pelvic clot using ultrasound.
You know, sir, one of the things you mentioned earlier was HIT. I know we could have done an entire podcast on that alone, but your thoughts very briefly on, one, how what is the true incidence you think really is of HIT, and you know, when we start to see some of these things, and what is your generalized approach to dealing with this patient? Do you have a set algorithm in place of when you suspect it, how do you suspect it, what are your next steps, and where you go from there?
I think it does occur. Okay, I think there's no question about that. I think the patient who has had multiple exposures to heparin is the biggest worry. Okay, that usually in our world of critical care is usually the vascular patient who mm-hmm. has been admitted numerous times, had numerous procedures, has been exposed to heparin on numerous occasions. I think that is the at-risk population that you really have to always think about heparin-induced thrombocytopenia as a possibility. I think in the routine injured patient, the trauma patient, and the routine surgical patient who is seeing heparin for the first or second time, it is a very uncommon occurrence, but it still can occur, and you still have to have it in the back of your mind. As far as how we, I think the key that everybody uses is to watch the platelet count on those patients. The problem is that a platelet count can go down for a lot of different reasons, and you have to remember that, especially if it's the first exposure to heparin, it's going to take at least 5 days for antibiotic production, and so that early thrombocytopenia, we usually do not get worried about. If it falls after 5 days, we do get worried. We then will send a PF4. We do not routinely send a SRA at the same time, although our vascular service feels very strongly that they need both tests, and so they still send both at the same time. We are able to get a P4 done if we recognize this early in the morning. We're able to get it by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So we usually hold the heparin while we're waiting for the P4. If we really, for instance, if we really think that the patient is being treated for a massive PE, we will switch them most likely to fondaparinux acutely, or some of our people will still use a gatraband, and then wait for the P4. If the P4 comes back negative, we go back to heparin. The vascular service will wait for the SRA. They are the ones that will still use a gatraband routinely. Nobody yet has switched. It's not indicated, so it would be an off-label use to any of the oral agents at that point. I think as time evolves, those oral agents will probably be what people will switch it to, especially a gatraband is a little hard to monitor. It's a little more expensive. And that's how we do this, at least.
That was great, sir. Thank you. And just to kind of wrap up this topic, what do you see for the future of anticoagulation?
Whoa.
Is there anything on the horizon that's coming near that we just don't know about yet that you may...
Well, I think what all the drug... I tell you what is going to... We are eventually going to have an antidote for the oral direct thrombin inhibitors. The group, I've seen some initial studies. The companies are working on it. They realize this is an impediment to the use of these drugs, and that's a financial impediment for those companies.
Definitely.
And so there is a lot of work currently being done on a proper monitoring, and that's where there's more evidence coming out of using TEG. And number two, there are a number of opportunities or possibilities for reversal agents. And I think that's the next thing that we are going to see in the field of anticoagulation that will impact not only critical care, but impact how we use anticoagulants in the future.
Sir, that brings one more topic I want to touch on. We were talking with Dr. Holcomb last week about using TEGs. How long have you guys been using TEGs in your ER and your ICU? And is it the residents, the attendings? Who's interpreting these TEGs and making management decisions on these?
Well, that's a great question. We were part of Dr. Holcomb's study with PROPER, so we introduced TEG at that time. It was a research tool only, and it was interpreted by the faculty. As a result of that, we convinced our laboratory to add it to our profile. And the way we did that is that it is under our massive trauma transfusion protocol. So anybody who is in the massive transfusion protocol automatically gets a tag. So we do not routinely get tags on everybody, but once we declare this patient is a candidate for the massive transfusion protocol, we send off a tag. It is available to residents and faculty. We have a special place on our electronic medical record where you can go and see the graphic as well as the tabular printout. And I would say that probably right now the tag is reviewed by the faculty with the residents. I think they are still learning how to use this, just like I think we are still learning how to use it. And that's how we have slowly incorporated it into our practice. It's very interesting. Now that we have it available, people are coming to us from neurosurgery as well as anesthesiology to basically say, you know, can you help us, you know, how should we be using this? So I think it's helpful. Once again, it's a tool. It's not the panacea to everything. And it's another test that we're going to have to learn how to incorporate into our clinical care.
So we're going to switch gears now, and we're going to finish up with our segment on tips and tricks. And today's tips and tricks, again, this is those helpful hints from our experts to get us out of those sticky situations, is going to focus on duodenal trauma. So two scenarios. The first scenario, sir, you have a 10-year-old child who comes in riding his bike, and he has a handlebar injury to his mid-upper abdomen. And on screening, what you note is that he has a large hematoma of the second portion of the duodenum. What do you do in this scenario? How long do you wait? Is there ever an indication to take this patient to the operating room?
Well, the answer to the last question, usually not. Usually you do not want to take these patients to the operating room, at least acutely. That would be a big mistake. The issues with the duodenal hematoma is, are they totally obstructed? That's the mm-hmm. issue. If they're not totally obstructed and they can get liquids by, then you can actually, once the patient's ileus resolves, if they have one, you can actually feed these kids and manage them in that fashion. Obviously, you know, we're dealing. The scenario provided me is essentially an isolated duodenal hematoma. Mm-hmm. You got to worry about the pancreas, mm-hmm. And you got to worry about a small bowel injury as well. But, I mean, in this scenario, we would first try to assess whether the patient was totally obstructed. If they weren't totally obstructed, we would try them on oral intake. Sometimes that doesn't work. And what then, your next step is to see if you can sneak. In a 10-year-old kid, you're still going to need general anesthesia, but what you would like to do is see if you can sneak a feeding tube through the duodenum, past the obstruction, into the distal duodenum or proximal jejunum, and then use that as feeding. Most of the time, these will resolve. The usual time we give them is 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And after 6 weeks, if they're still really obstructed, they can't get anything through, then you've got to think about operative interventions. Most of the time in the literature, by that time, just simple evacuation of the duodenal hematoma usually doesn't work. And so you usually end up with a duodenal duodenostomy. Mm-hmm. So you fold over the duodenum, over the area. And usually that's possible. There's usually a small area where the obstruction has continued to fibrose. If that doesn't work, then you can do a duodenal jejunostomy. That usually in the smaller kids is not it's possible, but it usually isn't needed. It's usually in the larger kids where they have a larger obstruction and you can't fold the duodenum over. But that's how we would manage, and that's how I've managed them when I've had that problem.
TPN in those kids, sir? If you can't get the feeding tube down and they truly are obstructed, how quickly will you start TPN in these?
Well, TPN is stored, and that's why I didn't want to mention it. But the TPN story is, sure, if you can't get the feeding tube down, but if you put the, you know, in our experience, you can usually get the feeding tube down.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of how much you're willing to push the issue and how you feel the difference between enteral feeding and TPN. We tend to feel that TPN is a treatment of last resort.
Mm-hmm.
It is not good for us. It's an artificial method of supporting their nutrition. When it's necessary, yes, we can do it. And it can be done, but everybody needs to remember that it is not the best form of nutrition. And so if push comes to shove on this patient, yeah, we would put them on TPN. We would probably not operate on them still for that 6 weeks because most of these will resolve. The only other one that happens is that if you have that same scenario, but you have a large retroperitoneal hematoma and the patient is still requiring fluid, then that may be a patient that needs early exploration to control bleeding that's usually coming around the duodenum from the retroperitoneal venous circulation.
Mm-hmm.
And under those circumstances, if I happen to be in that belly for some other reason, decompressing that duodenum is not a bad idea.
Assuming you didn't go to the operating room, you mentioned the pancreas. Will you get a MRCP on these patients just to rule out a duct injury or a pancreas injury?
Well, you know, unless you got something else giving you a hint that might be there, if you've got a reasonably good CT scan, and most of us, you know, we're now seeing things on CT scans we've never saw before,
right,
which creates another problem. But if you're using over a 16-slice CT scan, you're gonna see suspicious things around that pancreas. And if you don't see those suspicious things, I would not push, especially a 10-year-old, I would not push for any kind of diagnostic study to evaluate the duct.
Okay,
sir, second scenario. You have a 28-year-old male gunshot wound and takes out the lateral wall of the second part of the duodenum. What are your options and preferences in this situation?
Okay, the first thing I will say when people start talking about the duodenum is one of my mentors, Dr. Schneider, used to remind me all the time, it is a piece of small bowel. And so one of the things would be primary repair would be my first attempt. But if you're going to narrow it, then you've got some options. Number one, you could close it horizontally instead of longitudinally, which would give you usually enough space so that you wouldn't narrow the duodenum. You may have to release the ligament attrites to get enough mobility, which isn't a sin. You can reduce it or release it and then reattach it. It may not be attached as high as it was, but you certainly can do that. And that would allow you to do a primary repair. If you really think you have a destructive injury of the duodenum, in that location, it is a piece of small bowel. So your options would include you could put a jejunostomy up there. You could resect that area and do an advancement primary anastomosis up to the ligament attrites, or take the ligament attrites down again and then reposition it. I think that the location you gave me, I think every option that you can think of for a small bowel repair is probably reasonable.
Let's say you had a little bit of the pancreas involved. Either A, scenario where it's concerning about the duct, and then B, it just looks like just the pancreas is a little bit dinged and you got a pancreatic hematoma.
Well, remember, a pancreatic hematoma, the treatment of choice is still drainage.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to get by with drainage on 90% of those cases. You won't have a persistent fistula, and you'll be much happier, and the patient will be much happier. If you're talking about a major ductal injury, then you've got a different problem. And the major ductal injury, certainly a major duct injury in the distal half of the pancreas, we would resect. If the patient is hemodynamically normal, we would probably resect and leave the spleen. So we would do a splenic salvage pancreatectomy, distal pancreatectomy. If it's in the head of the pancreas, you've got some much more difficult options. If it's a gunshot wound and it's right through the head of the pancreas close to the ampulla, that's one of the indications still for a Whipple in association with trauma. On the other hand, if you have enough ability to drain it, you may get away with just drainage, especially if there's other injuries that are more life-threatening at the time. On the other hand, if it's the only injury, sometimes a pancreatico jejunostomy can help you out of that situation. And there's some of those situations that I think it is better to drain and come back and fight another day, which is also an option.
So there's still things in textbooks about tube duodenostomy, pyloric exclusion. Do you use these ever, and what role do they play?
Well, you got to remember the tube data, and you'll find some of my articles that have been written about the tubes. You got to remember that the tubes are there as adjuncts to the treatment. Prophylactic tubes have very little data to support their use from an evidence standpoint. From an experience standpoint, decompressing the duodenum with an injury to the duodenum is probably not a bad idea. How you do it, I think most people do it currently as a retrograde duodenostomy using some kind of sump tube, or you could just use a plain old drainage tube like a Jackson Pratt.
Mm-hmm.
The lateral duodenostomy is useful. You got to be careful how you do it. You got to use a small tube. You got to know how to manage the tube. Usually people use a Foley catheter, and one of the biggest mistakes is pulling the Foley catheter out in that small, when you want to get rid of the duodenostomy tube without letting the tube, the balloon down. That's a bad maneuver. That makes the hole bigger, obviously. So we usually, if we use a Foley, we usually deflate the balloon fairly quickly and then cut the balloon inflator tube or side port off so it can't be reinflated. As far as the operations for a severe duodenal injury that screw up the physiology of the upper gut, I would just warn everybody, beware. The pyloric exclusion is probably the best of the options. But when you take a 22-year-old and you give them a gastrojejunostomy, and they're going to live their normal life, they are at risk, a 15% risk of a marginal ulcer in that gastrojejunostomy. And that's the Houston data and the Houston follow-up. And nobody's refuted that data, and I have seen my few of marginal ulcers after a pyloric exclusion. I think it is helpful, but again, you got to understand, before you do that, you got to think, you know, is this going to be the best option for this patient over the long haul, not only the acute phase, but the long haul? We favor with a large duodenal injury that you can't close without stricture, we favor a duodeno jejunostomy, mm-hmm. where you free up the edges and bring up a jejunal limb and actually sew it to complete the repair. Serosal patch, some people believe in. I don't personally believe in, but that doesn't make it wrong. And as far as other procedures, the old burn procedure where you did a partial gastrectomy, did a biliary drainage, I think they're best left in our history books.
Now, sir, we're going to move on to our final section, what we call the final five. These are just some fun questions to get to know you a little bit better. The first question we have is, if we were to open your song library right now on your iPod, what would be playing? And do you play music in the operating room?
I do not.
So what was playing on your song library, sir? What's the most common thing? Do you listen to music ever?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Country Western, primarily. And I guess Willie would be high on the list, well as Toby Keith.
I like it. Number two, tell us about a hidden talent, passion, or interest you have outside of the operating room.
Oh, well, I guess it would be golf.
Handicap?
10.
Type of irons you play?
I have two sets, Callaway and TaylorMade.
And your driver, I'm going to say, is a 10.5 degree R7.
It is, actually, I have just increased it to 12, ooh, and it is a TaylorMade R11. Yeah.
Okay, sir, can you just take us back to one of your most memorable vacations or trips you've been on?
That's easy. I was in Switzerland with my wife and my daughter. And it was one of the best trips we have taken. I actually was working a bit as a consultant, but I had 4 days where we were free to roam around the country. We stayed in Lucerne, and we visited the Switzerland countryside, a bunch of castles, had a great lunch one afternoon in one of the castles with a Swiss cheese fondue, and it was great being with my daughter and my wife. Just had a great time.
Number four, if you didn't become a surgeon, what would you have become?
Well, that's easy. I would still be a veterinarian.
Excluding a veterinarian. I didn't get to finish.
That's not fair.
It's our podcast.
Boy, I was raised in the restaurant and catering business. My father was a restaurateur in Chicago. I worked in that business since I was probably 8 years old. And when my dad died, I was just a young faculty member, and he died suddenly, and my chair was kind enough to let me go home multiple times over an 18-month period to sell. But actually, during that time, I seriously considered going back to run my dad's business. I enjoyed the people. I enjoyed I guess you would say, watching them have fun at their parties, at their celebrations, sometimes at their ceremonies, and it was something that I could have easily fallen back into. But luckily, my chairman at the time convinced me that probably my dad wouldn't want me to do that. And so I sold the business.
We were guessing that maybe you were going to say a radio show host.
Sir, if you could go back into time and to tell yourself one piece of advice on the first day of internship, what would it be?
On that first day of internship, I would say the most important thing is to cultivate your collegial friendships, because you never know when you are going to need them. Because we all cover each other's back, and if you don't have those people to cover your back, you're going to be a very lonely intern. And a very lonely physician.
Well, that's definitely sage advice. Well, Dr. Weigelt, thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Knife. This has been, I can tell you, I know speaking for both Jason and Kevin and myself, we have learned a lot today and truly appreciate you taking the time out. And we very much hope you'd be willing to come back and join us on a future episode. So thank you very much.
My pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity. It's always fun.
All right, that's it for us today. Time for our closing count. Thank you for joining us at Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Special thanks to Dr. Weigelt for sharing his wisdom and experiences as it relates to anticoagulating the trauma patient. Join us next time as we go behind the knife with another in-depth discussion from one of the leaders in surgery. Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife and at our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience. So give us your random fact of the day, tips and tricks, and topics, and we'll try and incorporate them into our program. We're soon about to launch an episode geared for interns to give them our advice. So if you have any advice or tips, hit us up on Twitter or on our website, and we will include it in the episode that will be distributed to interns nationwide. Additionally, we are starting a new episode that will be titled Crossfire. This will be debates that are commonly had amongst general surgeons. The first debate we're considering having is bowel prep or not to bowel prep. If you have any other ideas or topics that you hear your attendings debating, and you'd like to hear it on Behind the Knife, hit us up and we'll be sure to get an episode out about that.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fash is closed and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.